Good morning and welcome. We're going to go ahead and get started if we could. My name is Dean Reuter, and I'm the director of the Federalist Society's practice groups. Thank you all for coming this morning. We very much appreciate your attending our Consumer Credit Protection Conference. I want to thank in advance the panelists for being here today as well and our co-sponsors as well. This conference was put together by one of our 15 practice groups. That's the Financial Services and E-Commerce Practice Group. But we're also very pleased to have co-sponsors supporting our efforts here today, and they are the Financial Services Roundtable and the Consumer Bankers Association. So thank you very much for your financial and other support. I also want to mention, I think everybody got one of the flyers at their place setting of a future program on obstruction of justice. It's going to be next Thursday, May 29th, in this same facility, different room, but here at the Press Club. There has been some talk, I know, in the press of criminalizing some of these loans that have been given in the history of the subprime mortgage crisis. So there might be a little bit of overlap, but I really don't expect much. That's really all I want to say. My job is just to introduce our moderator and get out of the way. Alan Farrell is somewhat new, at least in the leadership of the Federalist Society. He joined as an executive committee member of our Financial Services and E-Commerce Practice Group, which helps set the agenda for the entire practice group. He's a professor at Harvard Law School, and we welcome him here today. Professor Farrell.
Well, I want to thank everybody for coming, and I think this is obviously an extremely interesting and timely topic. I don't know how many of you saw the Wall Street Journal this morning, but the front page article is on the bill before the Senate dealing with some of the housing issues that we're going to talk about today. What I'm going to do is I'm going to say a few words to sort of set the stage, and then I'm going to introduce our members of our distinguished panel. And I might ask a few questions afterwards, but my main hope for this session is to get questions, answers, debate from members of the audience. So I encourage that. When I was thinking about this panel, the first thought I had is, what if we had a panel like this 6 years ago? We would be spending a lot of time talking about how did we get into this mess? The losses from the stock market, the internet bubble bursting, and there'll be a lot of discussion, how did we get here and how are we going to go forward in terms of regulatory environment, in terms of the business environment. The actual answer, or a large part of the answer in terms of the reaction to the stock market losses and the popping of the internet bubble, was Sarbanes-Oxley. And an epic wave of securities class action litigation, which is still some remnants of which are still ongoing. In the journal today, describing the Senate bill or the Senate version of the bill on housing, which I think some of our panelists are going to talk more about, there was the comment that some are comparing the bill before the Senate to the 2002 Sarbanes-Oxley Act. And as a corporate law professor, that got me a little nervous. So I think there's some real issues or concerns, at least with respect to some provisions of Sarbanes-Oxley and whether we really got it right, or at least portions of the answer right, in 2002. And I think one of the challenges is, can we do better in terms of responding regulatorily and in terms of business adapting to what's happened without perhaps making some of the same mistakes? Now, in terms of setting the stage for today's discussion, the distinction I want to make, and it's very simple, is the distinction between suppliers of capital and the demand for capital. And the suppliers of capital would be the investors that purchased subprime mortgages or mortgages or instruments that were tied to subprime mortgages. And in the supply of capital arena, there's lots of distinctions, but there's one fundamental distinction, and that would be investors that purchased, that were supplying capital by purchasing mortgage-backed securities, so securities that were tied to pools of subprime mortgages or mortgages more generally, and also investors who purchased instruments in collateralized debt obligations. These are the structures that would repackage mortgage-backed securities or certain tranches of mortgage-backed securities and then sell those off to investors. So we have purchases of mortgage-backed securities and then at another level, intermediation, purchases of CDOs, collateralized debt obligations. So that's on the supply of capital side. I want to point out three basic facts that when I started looking into these issues struck me as very important in thinking about what happened in terms of the supply of capital, in terms of what was going on in these markets in which investors were directly or indirectly investing in subprime mortgages. So the three facts I want to throw out there, and we may loop back to in the question and answer period, is first, is that many, not all, but many of the losses that we've heard about, the investment bank losses, the commercial bank losses, the losses suffered by investors, many of those losses are not losses on mortgage-backed securities directly. They're largely, or a very significant portion of those losses, are losses on collateralized debt obligations. That is, the investments in collateralized investments in these structures that repackage mortgage-backed securities. Second basic fact in the supply of capital side of the equation is where did we see the credit ratings fall down? Moody's, S&P, and Fitch. So we've heard a lot of discussion about the credit ratings got it wrong. They said something was AAA and it turned out to be junk. Where did we really see the dramatic decline in credit ratings? And where did the credit rating agencies really get it wrong? Where they really got it wrong was largely with the CDO structures. That is, the ratings that the rating agencies gave to different tranches and collateralized debt obligations. The rating agencies were much, much better, although far from perfect, much, much better with respect to mortgage-backed securities. So not only were the losses largely concentrated in the CDO space, although not entirely, but the problems with the credit ratings the credit ratings that were being issued is largely confined, although not entirely, with respect to CDO tranches. Third basic fact on the supply of capital side of things that I think is interesting is what is this CDO market? This market where you had very large losses being suffered as a result of indirect exposure to subprime mortgages by investors. Who are these investors? The CDO market is an institutional market, or in securities regulation jargon, a Rule 144A market. These are hedge funds. These are pension plans. These are very large institutional purchasers. These are not retail investors. Retail investors cannot, under Rule 144A, cannot purchase CDO instruments. So we're talking about very substantial losses in an institutional market. And I think that raises questions about or issues about how are we going to think about investor protection? Are we going to have investor protection for these institutional markets, for hedge funds and other institutions like them that were the purchasers in these CDO markets? Okay, so that's on the supply of capital side of things. On the demand of capital, that's the entities that were required financing from the capital market. So those would be the mortgage originators, the countrywides of the world, that were manufacturing these subprime mortgages that were then quickly sold off. Why did we see the entities that were demanding capital engage in the activity that they did, particularly with respect to underwriting quality? And did the suppliers of capital understand the nature of the subprime mortgages that were being lent, particularly the underwriting quality? And I think some of our panelists will have some thoughts on that. Okay, so I'm going to turn it over to our panelists now, each of whom is going to speak for 7, 8, 9 minutes or so. Maybe after that, there'll be some exchanges among the panelists, but also I'm going to open it up to the floor to get audience participation. Okay, our first panelist is Meg Burns. She is the director of the Office of Single Family the Single Family Program Development for the Federal Housing Administration, the FHA. FHA is apparently going to play a very large, or potentially play a very large role in the current pending legislation, so she's going to be busy. Meg Burns is responsible for all policies related to single family loan production, from borrower qualifications to property standards, and she's played a critical role in retooling the FHA and aligning the agency's insuring procedures and improving overall communications within the industry. Our second panelist is Alan Fishbein, who is the Director of Housing and Credit Policy for the Consumer Federation of America, often referred to as the CFA. CFA is a national nonprofit association of 300 pro-consumer organizations founded in 1968 to advance consumer interests through education, research, and advocacy. Alan was also a senior advisor in 99 and 2000 for government-sponsored entities oversight at HUD, where he helped supervise the establishment of new affordable housing goals for Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. And our final panelist is Jennifer Bethel, who is a professor of finance at Babson College. She's written widely in the areas of finance and financial regulation. She has a PhD from UCLA. In terms of government service, she was the chief economist for the Division of Corporation Finance at the United States Securities and Exchange Commission from 96 to 99. So, Meg.
All right. Thanks, Alan. I'm going to start out more on that demand side of the issue that Alan talked about. I, as he mentioned, am from the Federal Housing Administration, and we are a mortgage insurance company. And one of the interesting things about this topic for us is an issue that was actually raised in the promotional flyer for this session. There's a sort of a titillating question in there that has been raised over the last couple of months. Did the federal government in some way contribute to this mess that we find ourselves in because the federal government has specialized programs that help consumers achieve homeownership? And has the federal government put too much emphasis on homeownership, and have these programs in some way contributed to this situation? And I got to tell you, for me, the answer is a resounding no, absolutely not. There's, quite frankly, been a shift away from the government programs. And so I want to talk today a little bit about, from my perspective, what we've seen over the last decade, and particularly over the last 5 years. The Federal Housing Administration and Fannie Mae were created back in 1934 to help the nation out of a mess similar to what we find ourselves in today. And quite frankly, it's my opinion that what we saw over the last 5 years was a movement away from some of these great institutions that were set up to help achieve a real, for lack of a better term, public-private partnership in the housing arena. The United States of America has been fortunate to have one of the strongest housing finance systems in the world. We've frankly been the envy of many foreign governments because we have accomplished this beautiful balance between the private sector and the public sector. We have institutions in the government that complement and support the private sector. And since the creation of FHA and Fannie Mae in 1934, we've seen a very steady increase in homeownership rates in this country in a very sustainable way. The FHA and Fannie Mae, and actually there were other government entities that were created after Fannie and FHA, namely Freddie Mac, Ginnie Mae, the Veterans Administration, the Rural Housing Services, all play the same sort of role. But all of these government entities have helped consumers access prime rate financing, market rate financing, which has been critical to achieving sustainable homeownership rates in this country. Shortly after the creation of both Fannie and Freddie, In 1934. By about 1940, the home ownership rate was, I think, about 43% in this country. By 1960, it was about 65%. And there are researchers who will attribute some of that growth, if not all of it, to these institutions and the new products that were created by these institutions. They were longer-term mortgage products. Prior to the Great Depression, the primary mortgage product was a 5-year balloon mortgage. And prior to the Depression during the Depression, the consumers were called upon to put down about 50% down payment. So their loan-to-value ratios were about 50%. FHA and Fannie Mae created a 20-year product and created an 80 LTV product, which gave consumers coming out of the Depression a means to refinance out of their mortgages, gave lending institutions the cash flow that they needed, the liquidity that they needed to get back on their feet so that the banks themselves could get back in business. And then, of course, that helped stabilize local real estate markets because suddenly people could keep their homes, they had new financing, and, of course, this is what we need today from the government. So that said, these government institutions were set up to play this role and did a very, very good job of it through the 1990s, quite frankly. One of the most interesting aspects of this crisis that I don't think gets highlighted enough is the massive shift away from the consumer use of the GSE conforming loans and the FHA product. And I have some fascinating statistics. At the beginning of 2001, the GSE conforming loans represented about 60% of the total market. By 2006, GSE conforming loans were 33%. Precipitous drop in GSE conforming basic prime rate 30-year mortgages that everybody used to use. No longer the case by 2006. 2001, FHA was just under 10%, somewhere between 8 and 9% of the market. FHA has always been a smaller portion of the market. By 2006, about 2.5% of the total market. In 2001, subprime and Alt-A products that cost consumers a great deal more than the GSE-conforming products or the FHA product, they represented under 8% of the market. 2001. By 2006, they were close to 40% of the market. So what we saw was this massive shift away from prime rate, market rate financing that was accessible through these government programs, through mortgage insurance mainly, because both the GSE conforming products have mortgage insurance associated with them, and FHA is a mortgage insurance company, to a subprime Alt-A product where consumers were paying for the additional risk in their interest rate. They were paying substantially more for their loans, up to 3% more in the interest rate. Very risky proposition, quite frankly, but this is the direction the market moved in part because the investors made cash available for this. This is the direction the market moved in. And sadly enough, here's another interesting statistic. The primary borrowers of this type of financing were minorities. 2005 HMDA data shows that 53% of African Americans had high-cost subprime mortgages. Again, 2005 HMDA data, 37.8% of Hispanics had subprime mortgages. So we saw this shift away from these tried and true and safe and affordable government type products to these subprime, risky, costly products, and minorities very much were targeted and affected. Devastating, just devastating. One of the other interesting things that people don't talk about with this shift away from the government products was once people moved over to the subprime world, there was an interesting evolution in the subprime products that was also extremely dangerous and risky. In the early years of the subprime products, what we saw was just higher interest rates. We saw fixed-rate subprime products. People were paying 3 percentage points more on their mortgages, but they had access to credit. They had access to financing, so they took out these mortgages. As access to credit became easier, demand for housing, of course, grew, and we heard about all these bidding wars for the same house, and, you know, with the demand, house prices increased, and so suddenly we had these high-cost loans and these high-cost homes, and people couldn't afford it anymore. So the market came up with some new products, and we ended up with probably have all heard of the 327, 228 subprime products with a teaser rate, a low interest rate to begin with, and then the rate would adjust over time after this 2 or 3 year period. This was an affordability feature, but what happened was consumers, you know, were qualified at these lower payments, at these lower interest rates, and when the rates increased, well, maybe they couldn't afford them. But then soon, that wasn't enough, and the industry had to come up with some new products. So they came up with interest only. So for borrowers who couldn't even make the payment on that teaser rate, couldn't make the principal and interest payment, well, they created interest only. So they didn't have to pay any principal. And then soon that wasn't enough, and they decided, well, if the consumer can't even make the interest payments, let's just go with what they call a payment option arm. The consumer will make the minimal payment, absolute minimal payment. They don't even have to pay the full principal and interest. And along the way, the lenders stopped escrowing for taxes and insurance because that was another cost to the consumer on a monthly basis that, you know, made it, the product unaffordable. So taxes and insurance escrows went by the wayside. And they said, you know, sometimes we still can't qualify these consumers, so, you know, let's move to sort of low doc, no documentation. We won't actually verify their income or their employment. And, you know, we really moved in a direction that was very dangerous. And here again, I have some very interesting numbers. In 2001, sort of at the beginning of the time when subprime started taking off, there were no interest-only subprime mortgages. None. 2001. By 2005, they were just under 40% of the business. 2001, low-doc and no-doc loans, they did exist, and they were about a quarter of the business. But by 2006, more than half of the subprime loans were no-doc, low-doc. So the point is that the industry and the market moved away from the government products, the government programs that were created to give people access to affordable financing and to help create sustainable homeownership. And those were good programs, and moved into this wholly private sector dynamic that created a tremendous amount of risk. And I think one of the lessons that we can all learn from this is that perhaps the beautiful balance that we once had between the public sector and the private sector is a good thing. And we actually are already seeing in the bills that are pending on the Hill and in the conversations a movement back towards the good old-fashioned Federal Housing Administration and GSE loans, which is a very good thing. But I wanted to sort of just put out there and answer that question from my opinion, that the government didn't really contribute to this mess, and in fact, we hope to play a significant role in helping us get out of it.
Good morning. It's a pleasure to be here this morning, and I appreciate the Federalist Society for inviting me to this certainly very timely topic. I'm Alan Fishbein, as I was introduced, with Consumer Federation of America. And Alan, thank you for your introduction. And I'm always glad to be introduced by someone who spells Alan the correct way. I don't always see that. I would certainly concur with a lot of Meg's remarks regarding the nature of the crisis, but I would extend it a little bit because I think government did play a role in this crisis, but I think the role it played was through its passivity, it enabled a lot of the excesses and abusive lending practices that helped create the crisis to materialize. And I'm going to try to address some specific ways in which that occurred. But first, let's see what I think we all know and can agree upon. And that's the nation's facing a severe and widespread foreclosure crisis. It goes well beyond the level that we've seen in modern times. 20,000 homeowners are going into foreclosure a week in the subprime market alone. It's estimated that 2 million or more homeowners will lose their home this year and next if there's no concerted action. Fitch Ratings estimates that 43% of recent subprime originations will result in foreclosure. And it's widespread. 47 states have experienced increases in foreclosures since last year, on the average of 50% greater than the year before. And while the crisis certainly emanated from the subprime market, we feel, and many experts have written about this, that the crisis is growing and could extend into the Alt-A market that Meg spoke about, and even the parts of the non-traditional prime market. And the full impact of that probably will not be realized until the next several years. Now, things are so bad that the line you hear is that what's the difference between an industry analyst who's an optimist and a pessimist? Well, the optimist is somebody who believes this is the worst crisis since World War II regarding foreclosures. And the pessimist is someone who feels it's the worst crisis since the Great Depression. So you can decide where you fall in that category. But the primary victims, we believe, are hardworking families, not as it's sometimes been portrayed, as greedy individuals who are looking to extend themselves beyond reason, but hardworking individuals who, instead of gaining the benefits of home ownership, are struggling to keep their homes. And the impact of foreclosures and the foreclosure crisis extends just beyond those individuals themselves, but it has substantial negative effects on whole communities and, as we're seeing almost every day, on the economy at large. And so it's been estimated that over 40 million homeowners in neighboring properties where foreclosures are particularly severe will see devaluations of their homes, even though they've been making their payments every month on time as a result of the run-up in foreclosures, and that we'll see a total decline in property values and local real estate tax bases of over $300 billion, with an average decline in property value of in the range of about $5,000 for each homeowner. And as Meg said, this is being disproportionately felt by the traditionally underserved segments of our society, African Americans, Latinos, lower income individuals, who are disproportionately represented in the subprime market, where we see the the biggest foreclosure experience. The second point is that this crisis, as severe as it is, was an avoidable crisis. It really resulted from abusive loan products, reckless lending, a lack of accountability, which has led to the run-up in foreclosures and the current credit crunch. And it's very important to understand it's not typical of foreclosure run-ups that we've seen in the past. This one, in the past, the traditional foreclosure increases often result from catastrophic life events, job loss, divorce, illness, death in the family. While certainly these factors are present in this one, in many respects, the current crisis is caused by unsustainable mortgages, regardless of whether the income of the homeowner has changed or not. And tragic fact is the more drilling down we do in research, we see that many of the individuals who are in these unsustainable loans, which had many of the features that Meg was talking about, would have qualified for cheaper and much more sustainable loans. But through market failures and the lack of effective government regulation, they were steered into loans that just were not appropriate and had little chance of repayment. So some of the key factors that contributed to this were reckless underwriting, where the originator went too far in qualifying applicants based on lax underwriting standards, often at the initial rate for an adjustable rate loan whose monthly payments could increase considerably, certainly a failure to adequately consider the borrower's ability to repay the loan over the full term of the loan. The lack, in many cases, of verification of income, permitting borrowers to use basically a statement of what their income was, even when they had W-2s and could readily verify their income. And failure in the subprime market, particularly to escrow for taxes and insurance. And you combine that with the dangerous loan products that have been discussed, these 228s and 327s that had these built-in payment shocks, or even with the non-traditional products for the prime market, like the so-called payment option adjustable rate mortgage, in which a borrower can make monthly payments that do not cover principal and interest, in which your loan balance can actually increase in size, as most of these loans, it appears, are doing, you really do have the ingredients for a major collapse. And then you add on to that the mortgage broker and loan originator abuse, where you find that the brokers who have an incentive to close a loan and get their payment up front and not much of an incentive to consider whether the loan will repay over the life of the loan, this kind of misalignment of financial incentive for essentially unregulated industry contributing to the problem as well. And again, why I keep saying it was avoidable, as more of the research comes out, the Wall Street Journal estimated in 2005 that more than half of the people taking out these 228 highly unsustainable loans would have qualified for a prime mortgage. And in 2006, about 60% of them would have qualified for a prime mortgage. So this isn't necessarily uncreditworthy individuals who are in over their heads and government programs were pushing them into a loan they couldn't afford. It was the nature of the product combined with the underwriting practices that virtually assured these loans would be unaffordable. And then you couple that with the supply side, the Wall Street demand for more and riskier loans to feed some of the contours of what investors' appetites were for. And you see you have this kind of Gresham's law of the worst products in the marketplace driving out good products. And I've had lenders tell me that we kind of understood that the products we were offering were probably beyond the risk curve, the appropriate risk curve, but our competitors were doing it. We had no choice. We had to, if we were going to keep market share, we had to offer these. So in my mind, that's a market failure because the market's not working the way it's supposed to work. And then you couple that with the lack of oversight and regulation, which I think is certainly agreed to. The Federal Reserve Board had been mandated in 1994 by Congress to develop rules under the Home Ownership and Equity Protection Act to identify and prohibit or constrict unfair and deceptive practices in mortgage lending that would apply to all mortgage lenders. And the Fed had never gotten around to actually proposing rules in all those years. They eventually have, and rules were proposed last December and are still going through a comment period. But this is long after, you know, the crisis has emerged. Now, I guess the pure market view would be, well, the market's correcting. This may all be true, but the market's correcting. The bad lenders are out of business. Restrictions are, on mortgage lending are tightening up, and we're not unlikely to see a repeat of these practices going forward. But I don't think the evidence is that clear. Certainly the subprime market has, for the moment, declined considerably. But one of the trade publications, Inside BNC Lending, looking at loans originated and sold last year, found that 69% of them were adjustable rate mortgages. 40% of these loans had stated income, no proof of income. And two-thirds had prepayment penalties, which have the effect of locking people into what could be unsupportable loans. So there is some indication that some questionable practices are still continuing even in this period of, you know, quote, restrictive credit. And we believe that the financial incentives that created this crisis are still basically in place. They've gone into hibernation in large part because we're in a down market. Lenders are much more reluctant to make the kind of loan they would have made several years ago in this present environment. But that's different than they've disappeared. Mortgage brokers have the same financial incentive today as they had 2 or 3 or 4 years ago to place people into more expensive loans and for which they qualify. They get compensated for the most part through lender payment for placing them in more expensive loans, a so-called yield spread premium. So this all leads me to a conclusion that we feel is necessary, is that we need some strong public policy solutions to help clean up the mess and to prevent recurrence of problems in the future. We do not believe, unfortunately, the crisis will get better simply on its own. Home prices continue to decrease. They've already been down 5 to 10%, and the experts are predicting an additional 20% decline before it's over. And these falling home prices are creating a spiraling effect where homeowners, would-be homeowners, are hanging back because they feel the properties might decline further, and you're getting this excess supply, which further compounds the problem. Coupled with the fact that so many of the trouble homeowners are in so-called upside-down loans. Their mortgage balances are larger than what their home is currently worth. Some are walking away from the properties. It's been estimated 30% of families with subprime loans are in upside-down loans, and they cannot refinance. And that's why Federal Reserve Board Chairman Bernanke and others have recognized that loan balances must be reduced to avoid a continuation of unnecessary foreclosures and to avoid damaging the economy. The approach up until now has been a voluntary approach, meaning the hope is that lenders would find it in their interest to write down outstanding principal to current market value, and that would help make the loans affordable and keep people in their homes. Unfortunately, through a variety of factors I won't go into right now, there have been impediments to the widespread use of voluntary loan modifications, and they certainly are occurring at a pace that's far smaller than the foreclosures that are occurring in the marketplace. And so this brings us up to a couple of proposals that are pending in Congress right now, which we think are certainly interesting and deserve to be enacted, one in the House of Representatives and one in the Senate, that basically would create an FHA rescue fund in which the government would operate in conjunction with lenders and services who were willing to write down outstanding balances to a percentage below current market value. In other words, take a haircut on their outstanding mortgage balance that they hold. In exchange, the government would refinance them into an FHA loan that would be more sustainable for the borrowers. The value of this seems pretty obvious. There are potential costs and risks to the taxpayer, to be sure, but if done correctly, the benefits we feel could outweigh some of these costs. But the great unknown is to what extent will lenders and services actually voluntarily cooperate in this program as opposed to continuing the pace of foreclosure activity, which is far more dependable and because of some complications, some ways easier to do. And so we have long favored the need for court-supervised loan modifications through the bankruptcy court, Chapter 13, that would give borrowers an option if they couldn't work out a voluntary agreement from lenders to go into bankruptcy and save their home, something which bankruptcy judges cannot now do. They can do it for second homes. They can do it for commercial properties, but they cannot write down outstanding mortgage debt for principal residences. And there is legislation in Congress that would address that point. Unfortunately, it's been opposed very vehemently by the financial industry, and the legislation has not moved through Congress. So we think, to sum up, that we're in a very serious situation that's likely to continue. While there is a view out there that we ought to let the market clean this up, we think there are some reasons why it it's unusual situation, and it's difficult for the market to fully clean this up. And given the government's implication in creating this, i.e., failure to be an active regulator, we feel that we all have some responsibility through our government to play a very active role in helping to be part of the solution. Thanks.
I'm going to echo both Meg's and Alan's thanks to the Federalist Society for inviting us and for hosting this. I'm going to change gears a little bit. I'm going to go back to the supply of capital that Alan mentioned earlier. We've got sort of the demand. We've got the homeowners, the lenders who need to find capital, but then we need to actually find somebody who's willing to provide the capital. And that happens currently largely through mortgage-backed securities and collateralized debt obligations. If you go back and you think about the purpose of mortgage-backed securities, if you go back 10 or 15 years, it was really coming out of, in some ways, the housing crisis of the 80s, where you would have a local thrift or bank originate a loan, and then it would be on their balance sheet. And they were basically holding housing risk from a very narrow geographic area. The idea was is if we could find some way to get these loans off of these banks and thrifts' balance sheets, basically let them sell them, then they have new capital. They can go out. They can originate new loans. They know the market. They know the people in town. And meanwhile, we'll take that mortgage, we're going to securitize it, and we'll be able to spread the risk to a larger group of investors. Presumably, if you can spread the risk, then, in fact, you can lower the cost of capital because the most efficient holders of risk will be the ones that are holding that risk. So it seemed like a wonderful idea of a way to expand home ownership while you're keeping sort of the local lending, but you have a very wide geographic, perhaps even global geographic holding of that risk. Now, we've heard a lot of ways in which maybe this has maybe gone astray. So, for example, loans being sold before they're even originated. We've seen a lot of different changes in the market. We've moved from local thrifts and deposit-taking institutions to mortgage banks and mortgage brokers. They have slightly different kinds of incentives. But what that's meant is that as we're starting to see this crisis cascade, the housing crisis cascade through the capital markets, we're seeing a lot of devastation economy-wide rather than sort of in more local geographic areas. So if we look at what do we know? We know that to date, financial services firms have written down more than $250 billion. We know these estimates are now north of $1 trillion, so we have a lot further to go. We're seeing extensive layoffs in numerous industries. And, of course, when you're starting to see bankruptcies and you're starting to see write-downs, you're seeing a lot of litigation. That litigation is around bad sales practices, people selling these mortgage-backed securities or some of these different kinds of securities in ways that maybe aren't appropriate. We're seeing litigation around contracts. We're seeing litigation class action suits. Those class action suits, Alan and I have taken a look at them. In just the first 13 months, there was about 135 suits filed against 43 different defendants. These defendants include the rating agencies, underwriters, the loan originators. Basically, everybody seems to be suing everyone. And there are billions and billions and billions of dollars at stake. Okay, so what's behind this litigation? The litigation is around falling asset values. So when we think about an asset's value, how do you value an asset? Well, if you think about what you're going to pay for a security, you're basically looking at all the cash flows that are going to occur in the future, and you're going to discount that back at some interest rate, where that interest rate is a function of the riskiness of those cash flows. So if cash flows are higher, the value's higher. If the interest rates are lower because you're dividing by interest rate, it's going to, in fact, be a lower value. So what we're looking at in terms of these falling asset prices is either cash flows aren't as high in the future, which we understand because we have a lot of defaults and foreclosures, or these interest rates are higher. What does this mean for regulation? Let's take this back to regulation. In terms of a regulatory response, then, we need to think about a world where somehow these losses may not have occurred. So how could regulation fix this problem? Well, one answer is let's go back to the cash flows. Was there something investors didn't understand about these cash flows? Was there some kind of disclosure that was lacking that investors looked at these products and just didn't understand what was going on? Again, you know, this is one of those things you can sort of anecdotally do or you can do on an ad hoc basis. We went back, Alan and I went back, and we looked at disclosure of these mortgage-backed securities back in 2001 and then in 2006. And we did it for a number of different underwriters. And I have to tell you, you know, once you peruse 200 or 300 pages of 6-point font, there's a lot of information in there. What I will say is that when you put this information back to back against each other, if you look at 2001 and then you look at 2006, to my eye, it looks like the collateral just isn't the same quality. So what you're seeing is you see things such as lower teaser rates in 2006 than 2001. You see a higher reset rate in 2006 than 2001. So, and these are just sort of averages, but then they also provide gross breakdowns of this. You see much greater concentration of securities in this loan collateral within a single zip code. And remember, go back to why did we have mortgage-backed securities in the first place, and that was so you would have some geographic diversification. So you see a drop in the geographic diversification of the loans that are being packaged for these mortgage-backed securities. So we're seeing there's definitely some changes in the quality of the loan collateral that are very consistent with what Meg and Alan have said. You're also seeing lots of new products, and this goes back to Meg as well. Lots of new products. You're not seeing a lot of sort of very standard conforming types of loans being securitized. It's these new products. Now, one of the things that come out of asset securitization generally is most people on the street will tell you you don't know collateral until you've watched it for a while. You don't know how it performs. You don't know how it does under stress. And so one of the things that's happening throughout this period is you're seeing changes in the collateral, and we're not getting to see how it performs under stress. And so you're seeing a lot of changes in terms of collateral, but these changes are very much disclosed in these documents. It's not clear that additional regulation to improve disclosure somehow, it's not clear to me what was missing, what would have caused somebody to change their investment action. So I'm not sure disclosure regimes are necessarily going to be the answer. Historically, the United States, we don't have merit regulation in securities laws. We have disclosure regulation. We believe in sunshine. And the sun was shining pretty brightly on these, but somehow investors didn't anticipate sort of the kind of high interest rates, falling housing prices, and what that might do to this cash flows of these securities. So let me go back to the second piece of this valuation, which is the interest rate. Interest rates have firm-specific, but they also have market-specific factors. So if you think about what a firm-specific factor might be, it might be something like the way that firm's balance sheet is constructed. The market-wide factors will be something like counterparty risk or liquidity risk. I think as time goes on, as we start to decompose these changes in interest rates, these interest rates getting higher because we're seeing higher risk, that higher risk is largely coming from counterparty or liquidity risk. So how do you think about regulation when you're thinking about market-wide factors causing these declines in asset values? Well, this is one of the things that we're starting to see with some of the proposals coming out of Treasury and the Fed. How do you think about getting less risk around counterparties? How do you get less risk around liquidity risk? For most of these firms, if you look at the actual performance, when these write-downs came through, much of the write-downs didn't have to do so much with the cash flows, but the fact that these banks couldn't unload them and they needed to unload them quickly. And so that's where the liquidity risk came in. So they were getting pennies on the dollar, whereas if they had been able to hold them for a longer time period, they might have not seen the degradation of performance. So I think that is still an open question. We're starting to see proposals come forward as to how to think about sort of this systemic risk, the risk that took us close to the edge with Bear Stearns. And I'm going to leave that as an open question, but it's not an easy question to answer as to how you really focus in on those two particular risks. In terms of Alan's points on the CDOs, a lot of the losses that we've seen were in the CDOs. They were not in the mortgage-backed securities per se. The CDO market is opaque. It is a privately placed market. And yet the purchasers in those markets are financially sophisticated investors. These are big pension funds. These are hedge funds. And again, it's not clear what more you could have told these particular institutions. They certainly had the financial expertise or sophistication to understand what these products were. CDOs are far more opaque because it's basically taking mortgage-backed securities, many different mortgage-backed securities, and then re-securitizing. So there is some opacity to those. So I'm going to leave it at that and turn it back over to Alan.
Well, I'm going to make one comment, and I'm going to have a question for the panel, but also the panel should also feel free to object or comment on anything the other panelists have said. And then after that, I want to open it up to the audience. So the comment I want to make is, and this is building on Jennifer's remark, is one of the most fascinating things to me in this whole current crisis is what happened with Bear Stearns. Bear Stearns, a large part of what happened to Bear Stearns was it was financing its operations in the repo market, the repurchase market. That is, it would post its collateral. Bear Stearns would post collateral that it had, assets that it had, in the overnight market, and in return get cash. So it's basically they would use their assets as collateral for short-term loans from market actors. So if it had a treasury bill, it might post that as collateral and get cash against that treasury bill for a day or a couple days, and then they would swap again where Bear Stearns would return the cash and it would get back its assets. So Bear Stearns was, to a substantial extent, financing its operations in the short-term repo market. And related to what Jennifer was saying, and this is absolutely astonishing to me, is right before Bear Stearns went under, it was trying to raise cash to finance its normal operations, and the market actors that normally post cash against collateral were refusing to accept U.S. Treasury bills that Bear Stearns owned. So you had the full faith and credit of the U.S. Government in the form of a treasury bill, and yet market actors were not willing to accept Bear Stearns treasury bills and hand over cash using that as collateral. So there's something very strange going on here, because even if Bear Stearns went under the Bankruptcy Act as amended in 2005, the lenders to Bear Stearns would be able to just sell off the treasury bill and get their cash back that way. So there's something, to my mind, that speaks to some perception of liquidity risk or counterparty risk that even extended to U.S. Treasury bills that happened to be owned by Bear Stearns. So very interesting and probably unpredictable event that happened there, at least with respect to the repo treasury bill market. My question for the panel is, I think, and this is out in the public domain a lot, is to what extent should we, the government, or indirectly through government-sponsored entities, help bail out, I don't know if bailout's the right word, but help subsidize parties that took out unsustainable loans, and even accepting Alan's figure of 50% of these subprime lenders or borrowers could have gotten a better loan, a conforming loan, that still leaves 50% of the borrowers taking out loans that were unsustainable. And the policy question, I think, and I would like to hear people's thoughts on this, is should the government, or to what extent should the government engage in these subsidies, at least with respect to those subprime lender borrowers that took out unsustainable loans? And I think there's two aspects to this question. One is just the moral or fairness question about why should taxpayers or other parties that didn't engage that behavior fund such a bailout? Is that fair? The second and more economic question that this raises is this going to create undesirable incentives? You know, there's a moral hazard issue, obviously, if you engage in an activity that's dangerous or reckless, and then somebody else pays at least a portion of the costs. Is that going to set up undesirable incentives going forward? So if anyone wants to take a crack at that or anything else anybody has said,
well, I'll be glad to at least start, and then people can respond as they see fit. One of the things I was trying to emphasize with my presentation is analysis of what caused the problem, because I think that's very instructive, and then figuring out ways to climb out, and the role that public policy, meaning the role that the costs of some of this are borne more broadly by everyone, should play a role in it. And it seems to me there are three unusual factors involved here. One is that I think there's strong evidence that many, not all, but many of the borrowers in unsustainable loans were steered into products in which the originators knew these were not affordable to those borrowers at the time the loan was made. And so I think that has to be factored in. Now, in an ideal world, you'd like to be able to, well, we'll differentiate between the undeserving borrower and the deserving borrower. I don't know, given the level of this crisis, that we have that luxury to come up with that. And we didn't seem to worry about it with respect to other commitments of taxpayer funds that have been adopted by Congress under the heading of relief or addressing the foreclosure crisis, tax breaks, tax credits, a bailout to Bear Stearns. Second is the spillover effect, the fact that this is affecting a foreclosure crisis is affecting more than just those borrowers who can't make their payments. It's affecting their neighbors, affecting their communities. It's having a corrosive effect throughout the economy. The municipal bond market is finding it more difficult to raise funds. Everybody is being affected. And third was the government's complicity through non-action, which basically permitted this Wild West atmosphere of origination and sale and investment in the securities market to thrive, at least for a period of time. So I think those are three highly unusual circumstances that I think would be weighed even by those whose natural inclination is to say the government ought not to be involved in this and we just ought to let the market kind of work it out on its own.
I'd like to add to that a little bit. Obviously, on the regulation side, I think there's probably complete alignment in the government that additional regulation is necessary, that these lax underwriting standards were contributed to such a degree that it just cannot continue. One of the primary reasons that lenders moved away from the FHA and the GSE products is because why underwrite a loan when you can just, you know, have the borrower pay a higher interest rate and close their eyes and sign on the dotted line and here's your cash? FHA has always required the borrower to have the capacity to repay. We actually require the lender to call the employer and verify the employment, verify the income. It's much more difficult to get a loan where, you know, somebody actually has to perform some analysis to determine whether the consumer can actually make the payments. So on the regulation side, I completely agree that additional government intervention is necessary, and I think we're moving in that direction with the proposed HOPA rule and some other changes. On the programmatic side, government intervention is so much more difficult because it's very hard to balance out. Alan brings to light this issue of worthy borrowers versus unworthy borrowers and who should we be helping. And this has been part of the dilemma. But part of the problem is that a lot of the programs that are being proposed actually benefit the most irresponsible of the borrowers. So, for example, the FHA bill that's being contemplated in the Senate today has a feature where the existing lien holders would be required to take a write-off on the principal on the existing mortgages. Any existing subordinate lien holders who have a junior lien behind an existing purchase mortgage that somebody has, they would probably be required to take a complete write-off. So there is no ability for the existing lien holders to sort of negotiate with the consumer some amount of payoff, particularly on the subordinate liens, in a natural market-driven way. If they participate in this program, they have to take a 100% loss. Because of this sort of misaligned incentive structure, it only makes sense for those existing lien holders to agree to participate in this program if they were already going to take a substantial loss, which means that they're going to consider this type of a product only for the very worst of the worst business. So this type of a product will end up benefiting only those consumers who made, quite frankly, the most irresponsible decision, those perhaps who chose the option arms that we were talking about before, where they made a minimal monthly payment and the principal and interest that they weren't paying was being added to their loan balance. So their loan balance was growing. They're probably now in an environment where the values have declined. There's a substantial difference between the existing loan balance and the existing property value. These are the consumers who are most likely to benefit from that kind of a product. And I'm not saying that there shouldn't be an option for these consumers, but there is some fundamental unfairness that these are the consumers who probably will get the benefit when there are many other consumers who were steered into a subprime loan and didn't know what they were doing and also need an option. So this is part of the policymaker's dilemma in Washington right now. How do you structure a program to get us out of this mess that is fair to all consumers, that in some way can take into consideration, you know, who is responsible for this mess and how do they help pay for it. Another factor that we have talked about quite a bit in at HUD is that the concentration of these loans makes it very difficult to formulate a fair policy. So, for example, 25% of the non-performing subprime loans today are in California. Is it fair for taxpayers in North Dakota or Iowa to bail out California? And actually another 10% are in Florida. You know, so there are these dilemmas of, you know, what is fair and how do you balance it out given the dynamics of the product.
So I welcome comments or questions from the audience. There's a microphone up there if you're in the immediate vicinity. So please feel free to ask questions. Yes?
I can talk pretty loud. I'm not sure I need a mic. But
you can use the mic.
Okay.
I'm a retired bank examiner, and one of the questions I have is, Alan Fishbane, you mentioned bankruptcy in Chapter 13, I guess. What about some of the problems with the last bankruptcy law changes in 2005 where a lot of people took advantage of it, and now they can't refinance? What happens down the road if we encourage them to take bankruptcy again? Are they ever going to be able to get a mortgage product on prime terms?
Well, the individuals that would qualify are individuals who are facing loss of their home. So they're making a very difficult decision, number one. If they go into bankruptcy in Chapter 13, they would have to be eligible under very tight expense guidelines that were part of the legislation that you referred to. So this is not something we believe homeowners, if they have other choices, would contemplate. But we feel if a homeowner wants to stay in their home, which used to be one of the traditional reasons for going into bankruptcy, they should be afforded that option. And if the market cannot, because of fear of lawsuits by other investor classes against servicers, by the kind of misaligned some of the incentives that Meg was talking about, if that's an obstacle, and it's proving to be in the voluntary restructuring of these loans, that the homeowner ought to have an alternative. And, alternative looking at the situation that seems to match up the best would be through bankruptcy, which would involve no cost to the taxpayer, I might say. And Moody's economy.com and others have estimated would save 600,000 homes if this provision, as it is now, were adopted. And the provision is tightly tailored to certain types of mortgages, subprime and non-traditional, that were made during a certain period of time. The balance would have to be written down to the current value based on an appraised value, and the mortgage holder could use other features such as interest rate freeze or extension of terms in combination, all to keep the loan affordable and keep the homeowner in their home. And of course, ultimately, the holder of the note has the throttle. They could decide whether they want to do this voluntary short of bankruptcy or not. And we think it would provide an incentive for the voluntary approach, a so-called voluntary approach, to be used much more frequently than it currently is.
Yes, microphone's right over there. Please.
I actually had two different comments, if I can indulge myself. One is it seems to me we haven't discussed today, and one issue to be taken into consideration is the role of the increase in real estate values, and to what extent was that sort of bolstered by sort of very low interest rates emanating from federal policy. So I think that's one aspect. I've looked at some statistics, and if you look at the growth in mortgage loans from 2001 to 2010, you see a pretty high rate of increase. But if you compare the growth in mortgage loans with the growth in housing prices, you see that it's pretty much in line. So we're not getting more mortgage loans than you're getting increase in housing prices. So that tells us something. The second thing is, in terms of the role of federal government, there is a lot of concern, right? I think there is some concern about the expanded role of, say, the GSEs. And, I mean, I've heard some people basically say that the GSEs is a federally sponsored hedge fund, which could cause a lot of problems for the economy if they don't do things the right way. So,
I mean, I'm just going to basically restate the question, but I start off the panel discussion talking about 6 years ago we would have been talking about the stock market losses. Today we're talking about the subprime crisis, and is 6 years from now we're going to be talking about the Fannie Mae Freddie Mac crisis. So any thoughts on that issue or the fact that the role that housing price appreciation played in where we are today?
Well, I think there's no doubt that the interest rate policy encouraged increased mortgage lending, and that affected home prices. But ultimately, what created this problem was that income was stagnating, and the gap between median income in communities was falling further and further behind escalating home prices. And so first-time home buyers were particularly disadvantaged. Now, we believe those factors could have been present But if there had been effective consumer protection regulation in place and effective financial regulation in place, you still could have avoided the excesses that we've seen. And in fact, that would have made the case all the more for the need for effective regulation to make sure that the loan products and underwriting weren't doing as they did, kind of following this lag and trying to squeeze additional homeownership opportunities for people who formerly could not have had them. But I don't want to understate the misdeeds involved in the industry practice here. And it was something more than just natural market incentives. At the time that a lot of these subprime loans, these adjustable rate 228, 327 mortgages we're talking about, came into the marketplace, and before that, subprime loans were largely fixed rate mortgages. At the time that in 05 and 06, some of these worst performing loans were being made and peddled onto borrowers, the difference between a fixed rate subprime loan and a subprime and a adjustable rate mortgage was basis points. Essentially, they were being steered into a loan because the brokers were standing, were in a position to make a higher level of compensation from putting people into adjustable rate mortgages because those were viewed more favorably by Wall Street for packaging of these securities. So I just think that that kind of a misaligned incentive puts this in a different situation than some of the normal kind of supply-demand problems that you see in housing cycles. It contributed to the problem, to be sure, but it was also entirely correctable if we had had effective regulation in place during that period.
I want to add to that, too, because I think one of the things that is very apparent is that some of the artificial inflation in the prices was very much caused by people had access to credit in a way that enabled them to purchase a home that was way beyond their means. So in other words, these, for example, no documentation loans, if nobody verified employment and income, a consumer was qualified to purchase a property that was probably more expensive than they can afford. And what happened was that it increased the demand for the properties in a way that was definitely out of sync with the incomes, as Alan was referring to. And so, you know, it fed on itself in a very dangerous way. And I think there were a lot of people kind of watching that artificial market dynamic play out and were concerned about it. And yet, because there was no regulation in terms of the underwriting, it just continued and continued and continued. And I think that's why so many people have been saying over the last several years, well, there's got to be a bubble. There's got to be a bubble. The affordability index is out of whack. And indeed, it very much was. And I definitely agree that that contributed to this inflation. And that's one of the reasons that a lot of people are saying the best policy that we could use to get us out of this mess is to get those values back down where they should be, back to a level where the majority of families in the community can afford the homes. And what that will take is some time, and what that will take, unfortunately, are some losses and some foreclosures.
I want to add my own comment on this. It seems to me that in a situation where you do have rising housing prices and incomes aren't keeping up, that you do have an inevitable tension between the goal of home ownership versus you don't want people taking out loans that they can't afford. It seems to me that something has to give. So the question about the home prices rising, the home appreciation that occurred, for me, in part, raises the issue of to what extent do we want to pursue home ownership versus renting, and at what cost? Because, again, in that type of situation, and incomes aren't keeping up at the same rate, either you're going to pursue home ownership or but at the cost of perhaps at least a certain percentage of investors taking out loans that are not affordable. So, and I think that's one of the policy issues that needs to be addressed is to what extent is home ownership itself a good versus renting, at least in some circumstances.
I think I want to just add one thought on the GSEs.
One thing that did happen during this period is we saw some accounting scandals with some of the GSEs. And around that time, you saw a big contraction of their balance sheets. So I want to be a little careful about us thinking that the holy grail is the GSEs, because there's a fragility to them. They're businesses. So just as a side.
Just to comment on that. I think that's true. Meg, you mentioned those statistics of the conforming loan market, the business that the GSEs were doing, dropped by about 50% in 5 years. And effectively what was happening was the private market was bypassing the GSEs with this lower quality mortgage debt that they were bringing directly to Wall Street. And so the GSEs lost some of their traditional market share of this standard fixed rate adjustable safe adjustable rate product that that they've helped to foster liquidity for. And I think now, of course, their market share has increased considerably, particularly with the dry up of the subprime market. Now, they are public mission institutions, and they have this public mission to be fulfilling, which is to try to promote both home ownership but also affordable rental housing. And I think the GSEs play an important role in the rental housing market, that's something that is worth looking at going forward, because certainly we would agree at CFA that rental housing and the production of affordable rental housing units needs to have greater emphasis, I think, as a matter of public policy than it has in recent years.
Please.
At the risk of restating the obvious, the current subprime crisis emanates from two different sources: in the primary market due to the underwriting standards, and the secondary market due to the complexity around deal structure. But it occurred to me that the angst around trying to solve the problem in the primary market is not that difficult at all. In fact, the forensic accounting science exists and the IT technology solutions exist to be able to re-underwrite loans on a massive scale and re-qualify borrowers to find out what they could have or should have had, to re-qualify buyers at reset rates. There's a whole methodology to sort of do this in a very quick way to ascertain, borrowers that are victims and borrowers that just took a risk. But be that as it may, wouldn't it behoove a policy, a financial policy, that would ameliorate concerns both of the borrower and the ultimate investor by suggesting that borrowers, their loans be restructured into fixed rate loans at 85% of their LTVs aggregate and just extend their terms? So instead of a traditional 20 or 30 year, you're a 40 or 50 year, and hope that the market takes care of itself, where borrowers might be able to refinance in the future.
That's an excellent question, and one that we have grappled with quite a bit. One of the interesting things is that everyone is doing analysis of the data to try to figure out, how do we get borrowers into new mortgages? How do we modify mortgages? How do we put people into a product that they can afford? And if you look at the primary source of data that's being used in Washington for a variety of proposals is something called the Loan Performance Database, and it's the subprime loans that are in securities. And one of the things that's very obvious when you look at this data is that a lot of these consumers are in very serious trouble. They have very high debt-to-income ratios, very low credit scores. They were serial refinancers. They stripped the equity out of their homes. They now are in an upside-down situation where the loan balance is substantially higher than the value of the property. So the issue is, this is a consumer who could be put into an affordable product, but at a substantial write-down. And who is the party that pays that difference? Is it the existing lien holders who simply take a write-off on that amount, which many of us say, yeah, sure, that's a great thing. But the problem is, there are these contractual obligations associated with the mortgage-backed securities, the CDOs, the servicers who handle these mortgages have obligations to make payments to these investors. So how do you break that up, which comes back to the bankruptcy cram-down provisions? If there were a court order that mandated those write-downs, that would make it easy, but that doesn't exist. So that's part of the issue. And then the second part of the issue is the fairness, you know, getting from existing loan balance to this new loan balance that somebody can afford. If you're not going to do a write down, who would put debt behind a first mortgage that's secured by collateral? Like, how do you fill that gap?
By extending the term. So in other words, the investor would ultimately get paid back from P&I payments that would flow from the borrower over a longer term.
Which and they can do in a they can do it in a modification, obviously. But in a refinance transaction, the new loan is going to be based on the existing value of the collateral. So there's going to be...
No, I understand, but rewrite the loan. In other words, rewrite the loan. If a house is worth $100,000 and somebody's got a $150,000 loan, rewrite the loan to $75,000 and extend it in a fixed rate over a longer period of time.
What happens to the $25,000?
It's baked into the longer term. In other words, instead of paying over a 30-year rate, you would refinance the loan where the payments would be at a $75,000 mortgage, but the payments would be $150,000 over a longer term.
Oh, I see. Right. So you're saying the loan balance itself stays the same.
Correct.
And then
over an extended period of time.
Right, exactly.
Principal and interest payments would be tied to LTV.
Exactly, which is one of the options in a modification of an existing loan. And so some of the servicers are doing that. For some of the refinance transactions, it's not possible depending on the product. So, for example, for FHA, we don't have legal authority to insure a mortgage that's greater than a 30-year term. So we have a problem. We have actually asked for additional authority
and
to do that.
And I don't want my first comment to be lost either, that this, the anxiety and angst around figuring out who did what to whom in the primary market is a very, very simple problem to solve. And you're not going to solve it by looking at LP data because they don't have it. They relied on OFEO data up until 2000. They don't have that information. What you really need to do is roll up your sleeves, re-underwrite every loan. It can be done in a matter of minutes, literally, for portfolios because the technology exists. And get to the root of the problem. You'd be able to find out who the bad guys are, if there are any bad guys.
Right, and a lot of lenders are doing that. They're going back and looking at their portfolios and trying to re-underwrite. The issue is, where do you put the borrower? Where do you put the consumer? Can you do a mod or not? Is there a refinance product to put them into or not? And those contractual obligations between the parties, is it even an option to refinance somebody out of that existing mortgage and force the existing lien holders to take a principal write down? In many cases, no.
Yeah, but we also have to look at the reality of the situation as we're into more than a year of this crisis, and it hasn't happened thus far. And the reason is that modification is the last option that services traditionally have considered, and they've been very slow in making a judgment to change that calculation, and I believe still have not made that judgment. Their preference would be on repayment. They would prefer to freeze rates. They would prefer to even extend terms beyond existing terms if it was at the current outstanding balance. But unfortunately, because of the worsening marketing situation, people are walking away from their homes. And that's probably the thing that that the mortgage industry fears the worst, that people may take a look at their outstanding debt and say, egads, I can't pay this down. I'm leaving. Here are the keys. And, you know, I think under a lot of this discussion is kind of the assumptions you bring as to whether government action would accentuate that kind of so-called jingle mail approach, or would encourage borrowers to stay in their homes and pay affordable mortgages. We think the latter is the case if it's crafted carefully. But the reality is, up till now, the kinds of approaches you're talking about just have not occurred in the numbers that they need to occur.
This is a question regarding the CDO market. With the complexity of the CDOs and the sophisticated investors, do you think there's any culpability on the part of the issuers who took fees at the CDO creation for trying to minimize the risk with credit default swaps, or the rating agencies that are paid by the industry in order to post the ratings on the different securities?
I'll take a first crack at that. One thing that Jennifer and I were told when we talked to the rating agencies with respect to the CDO tranche ratings that they handed out, And it's consistent with what we heard from other people in the industry as well, so it's not just their say-so, is that a lot of these issues that we're talking about today are about unexpected correlation in bad outcomes. That is, there's correlation in default risk across the country. One source of correlation that was probably unexpected was the following. What CDO structures did was, once a particular CDO structure got the AAA for the highest tranche from a credit rating, other CDO structures, other investment banks would hear about that and say, we want that too, and now we know how to get it, which is, we're going to structure our CDO according to the guidelines, or according to the way we're going to structure our CDO in the way in which the previous CDO was structured in order to get that credit rating as well. And so you saw correlation in CDO structures as a result of their desire to get the highest credit rating. And so what happened in part was, if Moody's or S&P got one CDO structure wrong, or one, or the highest tranche in a CDO structure wrong, they basically got a huge percentage of the market wrong because you had hurting in structures. So, you know, one of the things that Jennifer and I talk about in our paper is that this is one source of unexpected correlation. So Moody's got one CDO structure wrong. Guess what? It got everything wrong, or a lot of it wrong. And that's probably one reason why you saw the terrible quality of credit ratings with respect to CDOs, is this unexpected correlation. One other comment I'll make on the CDOs that goes to transparency and how observable this was, is it, you know, you go on Bloomberg, you can basically get price and transaction data for all mortgage-backed securities, because it's all registered, and basically all asset-backed securities. You basically get zip for CDO pricing and transaction data. So the level of transparency to be able to figure out what's going on is very low. We asked some investment banks if we could get their CDO data, and they told us to go away. There's no way they're going to give it out, particularly since they're being sued for billions of dollars. But I'll hand this over to Jennifer.
To the first part of your question about the credit swaps and how culpable were these underwriters, sort of two thoughts. One is, you know, that was a basically fee for service, and that they did get fees for structuring these products. But they kept a lot of this stuff on their books. Otherwise, we wouldn't be seeing these huge write-downs. And I think the thing that was difficult to tell at the time was what the risk was. And it goes back to this counterparty and this liquidity risk. So, for instance, if you go back and these banks all have, every year they have to put out a value at risk estimate. And if you go back and look in 2006 at their annual reports and look at their value at risk estimates, what you'll see a point estimate, and many of them will give a range as to what they think their value at risk is. If you then go and look at the write-downs to date, you will see very little correlation between what they thought their risk was and what their write-downs have actually been. So if you look at, like, one of the highest value at risk estimates in 2006 was Goldman Sachs. They've had some of the lowest write-downs. One of the lowest value at risk estimates in 2006 was Merrill Lynch, and I think they're second highest in terms of write-downs at this point. So, you know, I think there are risk programs in place, but the truth is, I think there was liquidity and credit risk that was not understood. The other thing that's hard to understand is how the market is going to respond. So I've been told anecdotally on the Friday before Bear Stearns nearly went under, Bear had about $4 billion in margin calls against it. Bear paid their margin calls. Bear then went to collect the margin calls that it could collect, and basically nobody paid up. Nobody's going to give somebody who's about to go under a dime. And so, you know, there's all these things that happen on the, you know, as you get close to sort of financial distress that you can't anticipate in a rational world when you're trying to understand what your risk might actually look like. So I think that's where, again, going back to some kind of a regulatory response, you have to be able to think sort of out of the box as to how market participants are going to act under duress or stress.
Can I just follow up with one? You estimated that the total loss will be $1 trillion. Is that going to be based upon what they think is the actual predictive cash flow when they break all these CDOs apart, or is it basically the market risk, the illiquidity risk? How exactly is that $1 trillion being calculated?
Those estimates are coming from some of the analysts, and I don't know their exact methodology, but my sense is a lot of it's going to be around liquidity risk and counterparty risk. Can you actually unload these things?
Okay, thank you.
One quick comment on that. If sort of the D-Day for counterparty liquidity risk is you can date it. It's August 9th, 2007. So if you look at the London Interbank Offering Rate, which is the London Wholesale Money Market for unsecured lending, and the difference between that rate and the three-month Treasury rate, which one can use as a proxy for the risk-free rate. So you look at that spread, it basically 2005, 2006, first half of 2007, nothing, basically. And then 2007, August 9th, it just explodes. Huge difference. And that spread is often used as a proxy for counterparty liquidity risk. And we've been an elevated train ever since. So you can actually try to quantify some of the things that Jennifer's been referring to by reference to these different spreads. Yes.
Hi, Todd Zwicky, George Mason Law School. I have a question about foreclosures and the questions it raises about the efficiency and the fairness of responses. Foreclosure, we know, can result from two different factors. One will be somebody gets an unexpected increase in their payments, payment shock type situation, and they want to keep their house, and they're unable to afford it. A second model, though, it treats foreclosure as a form of a put option, where basically people decide when their house goes down in value that it's no longer worth keeping it, no longer worth making the payments. And so even if they could make the payments, they just decide to give it back to the bank, right, the jingle mail phenomenon. So first question is, do we know how many people are in the first batch of people and how many are in the second batch of people? And the second related question is, it was mentioned earlier that 25% of the loans that are in foreclosure are in California, for instance. What we know is that as the value of that option, the put option, goes up, people become more willing to exercise it. So, for instance, empirical evidence has demonstrated that states that have anti-deficiency or non-recourse laws that limit the ability of lenders to not be able to get deficiency judgments against borrowers, historically those states have always had higher foreclosure rates, especially in situations when property values fall. And I don't think it's a coincidence that the states that are clustered at the top of the disproportionate foreclosure rates today are states like California, Colorado, Arizona, all states that have anti-deficiency laws and non-recourse laws. And so the second question I would ask then, if a large part of the problem, or at least some of the problem, is California's problem by giving people incentives to walk away from their homes, why is that Washington's problem in states where people where states have not adopted such debtor-friendly laws?
Do you have estimates of the percentage of people you think are in a situation where they're walking away from their home?
You know, it's such an excellent question. I hope somebody here can answer it, because we have heard that more and more families are exercising the put option, and this has been a cultural phenomenon that a lot of people are talking about in Washington. But I have yet to see any data that tells us, and it's interesting to put it in the context of the state laws and whether that is having an effect on it. I would love to know. Maybe somebody should do some research on that.
See, I still think that's looking at the back end of the problem rather than the front end that, ultimately resulted in that problem. The lack of equity that was involved in a lot of these home purchases, ultimately mean that borrowers might be in a position where they have to contemplate that. We did an analysis. I think there might be a reference. I haven't seen in some of the materials. We put out a study in California, Mark, and we looked at subprime lending and the higher incidence, like three times higher, of the use of piggyback second mortgages. People were receiving 100% or close to 100% financed mortgages with little equity involved
in the purchase of the property. So, you know, you can look at it different ways, but one is that you think lenders and the industry would build in the additional risk of that low or no equity loan and would be able to take into account situations like the one in place. Apparently they did not, and they underestimated what the outcome would be. Or secondly, you could have more prudent underwriting standards that would, you know, look behind the capacity of the borrower's ability to repay the loan, which, as we've talked about this morning, fell by the wayside. So, you know, I kind of understand your point, but I don't think, you know, the anti-deficiency judgment states are driving the outcomes we're seeing now. I think it's been the lax underwriting process at the front end that leads to the fact we've been having a discussion like that now.
Wait, I just want to add something to that. I don't think it is necessarily contributing to the problem overall, but I think it's an interesting point that borrowers might take that into consideration. You know, am I going to owe something beyond this, or does it make sense for me to just walk away? And given that people are saying that more and more borrowers are opting to just walk away, it is an interesting dynamic. You know, are these laws actually contributing to that decision in a way?
Yeah, it goes back to incentives.
Incentive, exactly.
But even if there's a correlation between the presence of a state anti-deficiency law and higher defaults, doesn't prove causation. So you can imagine a state with historically high default rates, and there's the political economy is such as that is that they want anti-deficiency laws. So the causation could run the other way. It doesn't cause it, but it's rather a reflection of the high delinquency rates. And I imagine it would be very difficult to disentangle that. And you could also imagine another story where an anti-deficiency law would actually reduce subprime risky mortgages because the lenders know that they're going to walk away if things turn ugly. So the story told sounds plausible, but I would want to see, you know, the empirical study that would actually show causation.
And the other point I would add to that is basically there are other options that foreclosure, as most people who counsel troubled borrowers would say, is the least desirable option, will have the greatest adverse impact on your credit record for many years to come. And so borrowers typically, you know, explore the possibility of short sales and other pre-foreclosure alternatives before they get to the foreclosure stage. And I think it's been the lack of full-scale use of some of those other options that, you know, even have affected the problem of those borrowers ultimately deciding to walk away. I don't think that's anybody's first choice if they possibly can avoid it.
Please.
I had a question based upon a statistic Alan quoted earlier that at one point, over half the people getting 228s would have qualified for conventional loans. Do you know whether that data showed they would have qualified at the same dollar amount or just qualified for a lower dollar amount? Because I think that may affect the analysis of where the blame is spread. If it's at a lower dollar amount, there's some indication that borrowers may have been reaching for properties they couldn't afford.
No, I think this was based on an analysis the Wall Street Journal did in December of last year, and it was making a judgment whether the borrower had credit that was sufficient for a cheaper prime loan. And we know there's a big difference between the subprime market and the prime market. So they were suggesting half of the borrowers would qualify for what are substantially cheaper prime loans based on the examination of their credit record.
Was it the borrowers or the borrowers that were in default?
No, this was a borrower was taking out subprime mortgages.
Okay. So I guess I have a question. We have a couple minutes left, and I wanted to get this out on the table. And I think Alan touched on this in his comments, but I think it's worth talking a little bit more about it. And this is the whole supply capital versus demand for capital. So, you know, so here's a story, and I would like to get people's thoughts on it. You were able to get these subprime loans and maybe some very inappropriate subprime loans as a result of Wall Street willing to finance it. So you can't have this process could not have gone on without Wall Street supplying the capital. And that's just not going to be possible going forward, or it's not going to be possible, or it's only going to be possible perhaps at a greatly reduced rate because these investors have taken an enormous bath and they're just not going to go along with the same quality of the underwriting, the same quality of the underwriting going forward. So that's a story for a potential market correction that would ensure that we don't end up in the same place again 6 years from now. And I'm wondering where I've gone wrong or how that story's incomplete, and hence the need for government regulation, at least government regulation, to prevent a recurrence of this subprime crisis, i.e. Wall Street's unwillingness to fund this going forward, given the huge losses that have occurred to date.
And I would agree that the massive contraction in the credit markets as a result of the investor skittishness is serving as a form of correction today. And I can speak from the FHA perspective. One of the things that we're seeing is a huge surge in FHA business. Now the lenders are originating new FHA loans. They're busily refinancing borrowers in subprime product into FHA loans. A year ago represented about 3% of the overall mortgage market. Right now we're about 10% of the market, and the prediction is that we'll be 30 to 50% of the market over the next 2 years. And this is a form of market correction now that the risky subprime product is not available because investors have zero appetite for it. Lenders are returning to those good old government products and putting the consumers there, and this is actually a good correction to see.
Well, I think restoring government, investor confidence in the mortgage market, be it subprime or anything else, will depend on quality insurance in the form of effective consumer protection regulation, so that investors know that the borrowers taking out loans have the capacity to repay the loan, and there are consequences for those who make loans to borrowers without adequate consideration of that. It seems like a simple proposition. Unfortunately, it's had very tough sledding in Congress. A bill to do that passed overwhelmingly the House of Representatives, but hasn't gotten any further. There's a companion bill in the Senate that hasn't moved, and it's entirely likely and probably probable at this point that we will, this Congress will close up shop without having done a serious upgrade of consumer protection laws. And I think that will have an impact on investor confidence in the marketplace. In our view, it's really a win-win situation for industry and consumers alike to have a certain quality assurance that investors can rely on, particularly since we're likely to see an era of a variety of different mortgage products in a way that's different than the traditional reliance on the standard fixed-rate mortgage. Some of my consumer advocate colleagues might take a different view, but we think there's a role for a proper subprime product that reflects the incrementally higher risk of a borrower in the marketplace. It wasn't subprime that killed the beast. It was subprime of a particular product type combined with risk layering that ultimately was unsustainable. So it's not whether risk-based pricing per se is not a useful approach for making credit available to those who can't qualify for the cheaper prime credit. But it's how it's done. And unfortunately, the subprime market, because of the lack of regulation, has been rife with predatory and abusive lending practices since its inception. And unless we clean that up and get it right going forward, we may face a similar situation down the road.
Who's objecting? Who's making the objection?
The mortgage industry, to put it most directly, that they would prefer to emphasize disclosure, consumer disclosures, and let consumers judge for themselves as to what product to take out. And while we certainly favor, and I think everybody's got to favor, improvement on the current form that disclosure takes when you take out a mortgage loan,
Meg's department's involved in a rule writing for the Real Estate Settlement Procedures Act to provide better information. We ultimately think that the most vulnerable group, disclosure will not ultimately be sufficient, that there needs to be certain sensible standards of underwriting that consumers, investors, everyone in the industry can rely on.
Well, with that, we're right on time. So I want to thank the panelists for a great discussion. And we're going to have lunch here at 12 o'clock. It's 11:45 now, so you're actually going to have to go out in the hallway and mill about a little bit while they set up for lunch. So about 10 minutes or so outside while they prepare the room for lunch.
Yes, Alan, is your paper...